Hello. Today is Monday, and it is the 30th of August, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you today. We're going to start out with the weather, see what's going on this week, and then we'll move to stories of local interest, regional interest, and national interest throughout the hour. There are no obituaries today, so we'll just continue throughout the hour. So let's get started. Siouxland's five-day forecast, starting with today, some sun and a thunderstorm or two possible, high of 78. Tonight, severe thunderstorms in the evening, low of 63. Tuesday, partly sunny and humid, high of 77, low of 60. Warmer on Wednesday, partly sunny, breezy, high of 83, low of 66. About the same thing on Thursday, partly sunny, breezy, and humid, high of 86, low of 65. And on Friday, mainly cloudy and humid, high of 80, low of 62. So that's our week ahead. Let's get started with our front page. We're going to start with the mini editorial, which is brought to us by the Journal Editorial Board. They say, as Labor Day approaches, make the most of summer before it slips away. Suggestion, head down to Art Splash this coming weekend. This is the opinion of the Sioux City Journal Editorial Board. Speaking of Art Splash, there's a lovely article, lovely picture on the front page called A Celebration of the Arts. It's a picture of Erin Weber Driesen, Sioux City Art Center Development Coordinator, and she's shown at the Art Center in Sioux City. The Art Center will hold its annual Art Splash art show on its downtown campus over the Labor Day weekend. About 50 vendors are expected to sell their art. New place and more family fun. Sioux City's Art Center's Art Splash moves downtown. Even though it was inaugurated 28 years ago, Erin Weber Driesen still reminded herself that this year's Art Splash will only be the Sioux City Art Center's 27th festival. Like most things, the 2020 Art Splash took a year off due to COVID. She said of the popular Labor Day weekend event, and that isn't the only thing that will be unique to this year's Art Splash. When it returns on Saturday and Sunday, it will be held entirely on the Sioux City Art Center's 225 Nebraska Street campus. 2019's Art Splash was held at Riverside Park. Previously, the festival bounced between Riverside Park, Grandview Park, and originally near the Anderson Dance Pavilion down by the Missouri River. During our off year, we had a chance to reassess Art Splash's goals and priorities. Our goal is to make the festival more accessible to more people than ever, while refocusing our attention to all art and culture in the region. More than 50 exhibiting artists will be displaying and selling many of their best pieces all along the courtyard of the Art Center. Joining the artists will be a kids' fun zone as well as a multitude of food vendors. In addition, an eclectic lineup of live entertainment from musicians like the Langleys, Little Red and the Medicated Moose Band, and magicians like the Amazing Arthur will dazzle audiences during the two-day festival. Weber Driesen is especially pleased that each of the Art Center's indoor galleries, including its hands-on gallery, as well as the Gilcrest Learning Center, will be buzzing with activities all day long. Plus, for the first time in Art Splash history, the Siouxland International Film Festival will be screening many of its most critically acclaimed movies in the Art Center's newly updated Stark Lecture Hall. This fits into Weber Driesen's concept of Art Splash as a vehicle for all types of art. Everyone took a hit during the pandemic, especially the arts community. That's why we're increasing the scope of this year's Art Splash. To draw more people to the festival, Art Splash will have free admission to the public. According to Weber Driesen, this will allow Art Splash to feel more like a downtown festival, encouraging attendees to spend time at the Art Center and exploring nearby events. In fact, Weber Driesen said facilities like art centers are considered quality of life considerations for businesses and individuals moving into communities. We frequently host out-of-town guests who are amazed that a community the size of Sioux City can be home to such an outstanding art gallery, she said. Mainly Art Splash will be time for some family-friendly fun. We were very disappointed there was no Art Splash last year. Since we were able to reassess the event and refocus the event, there may be a silver lining in it for having an off year. So if you go, Art Splash will be at the Sioux City Arts Center's campus when on Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 3. Where is this located? At 225 Nebraska Street. Admission is free. And there will be 50 exhibiting artists, live entertainment, food vendors, kids' art zone, kids' fun zone, and free film screenings and more. Okay, sounds like fun. Another front page news, Ida leaves New Orleans without power. In New Orleans, Hurricane Ida knocked out power to the entire city of New Orleans, hours after blasting ashore as one of the most powerful storms to ever hit the U.S., or New Orleans government officials said. The city's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness said on Twitter that energy company Entergy confirmed New Orleans has no power and that the city power was coming from generators. The message included a screenshot that cited catastrophic transmission damage for the power failure. The National Weather Service said Ida, which came ashore as a powerful Category 4 hurricane, had weakened to a Category 3 storm, with top sustained winds up to 115 miles an hour as the eye moved west of the city. Ida made landfall earlier in the day in Louisiana with winds of 150 miles an hour, blowing off roofs and inundating coastal communities with a powerful storm surge. It came ashore on the same date Hurricane Katrina ravaged Louisiana and Mississippi 16 years earlier. The rising ocean swamped the barrier island of Grand Isle as landfall came just to the west of Port Fortin. Ida made a second landfall about 2 hours later near Galliano. The hurricane was churning through the far southern Louisiana wetlands, with more than 2 million people living in and around New Orleans and Baton Rouge under threat. This is going to be much stronger than we usually see, and quite frankly, if you had to draw up the worst possible path for a hurricane in Louisiana, it would be something very close to what we're seeing, said the governor. People in Louisiana woke up to a monster storm after Ida's top winds grew by 45 miles an hour in 5 hours as the hurricane moved through some of the warmest ocean water in the world in the northern Gulf of Mexico. Wind tore at awnings, water spilled out of Lake Pontchartrain, boats broke loose from their moorings. The Coast Guard office in New Orleans received more than a dozen reports of breakaway barges. In Lafitte, about 35 miles south of New Orleans, a loose barge struck a bridge. Elsewhere, engineers detected a negative flow on the Missouri River as a result of the storm surge, the U.S. Corps of Engineers spokesman said. He watched live video feed from Port Fortin as Ida came ashore. The storm surge is just tremendous. We can see roofs have been blown off the port buildings in many places. Officials said Ida's swift intensification from a few thunderstorms to a massive hurricane in just 3 days left no time to organize a mandatory evacuation of New Orleans' 390,000 residents. The mayor urged residents remaining in the city on Sunday to hunker down. One resident said he felt confident riding out the storm in his home in New Orleans' lower Ninth Ward, one of the city's hardest-hit neighborhoods when levees failed and released a torrent of flood water during Katrina. His home was among those rebuilt with the help of actor Brad Pitt to withstand hurricane-force winds. But the memory of Katrina still hung over the latest storm. It's obviously a lot of heavy feelings and, yeah, potentially scary and dangerous. The region getting Ida's worst included petrochemical sites and major ports, which could sustain significant damage. It is also an area that is already reeling from a resurgence of COVID-19 infections due to low vaccination rates and a highly contagious Delta variant. New Orleans hospitals plan to ride out the storm with their beds nearly full, as similarly stressed hospitals elsewhere had little room for evacuated patients. And shelters for those fleeing their homes carried an additional risk of being flashpoints for new infections. Forecasters warned winds stronger than 115 miles an hour threatened Houma, a city of 33,000 that supports oil platforms in the Gulf. Comparisons to the August 29, 2005 landfall of Katrina weighs heavily on residents bracing for Ida. Katrina was blamed for 1,800 deaths as it caused levee breaches and catastrophic flooding in New Orleans. Ida's hurricane-force winds stretched 50 miles from the storm's eye, or about half the size of Katrina. And a New Orleans infrastructure official emphasized the city is in a very different place than it was 16 years ago. The levee system has been massively overhauled since Katrina, said before the worst of the storm hit. While water may not penetrate levees, Green said, if forecasts up to 20 inches of rain prove true, the city's underfunded and neglected network of pumps, underground pipes, and surface canals won't likely be able to keep up. At least 619,000 customers were already without power on Sunday after nightfall. The Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality was in contact with more than 1,500 oil refineries, chemical plants, and other sensitive facilities, and will respond to any reported pollution leaks or petroleum spills. He said the agency would deploy 3 mobile air monitoring laboratories after the storm passes to sample, analyze, and report any threats to public health. Louisiana's 17 oil refineries account for nearly 1/5 of the refining capacity, and its 2 liquefied natural gas export terminals ship about 55% of the nation's total exports. Statistics show that 95% of oil and gas production in the Gulf region was shut down as Ida made landfall on Sunday. Louisiana is also home to 2 nuclear power plants, one near New Orleans and one 27 miles northwest of Baton Rouge. President Joe Biden approved emergency declarations for Louisiana and Mississippi ahead of Ida's arrival. He said Sunday the country was praying for the best for Louisiana and would put its full might behind the rescue and recovery effort once the storm passes. All right. Bernie Sanders was in Iowa, stumping for big budget. He says $3.5 trillion plan is a boon for working families. In Cedar Rapids, concerned that everyday Americans don't understand the most consequential piece of legislation for working families that we've seen in this country since the New Deal of the 30s, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders spent Sunday afternoon in Cedar Rapids explaining it. I'm doing my best to get around to do the best I can to explain what's in this legislation, Sanders said just before taking the Nubo City Market Bankers Trust stage in Cedar Rapids to address a few hundred people as well as a national audience watching via live stream. It was his third stop in U.S. House districts where former Donald Trump increased his support in 2020. Although the live audience appeared to be on his side, its loudest cheers were when he called for Medicare for all. Sanders said his message was for Democrats, independents, and working-class Republicans who recognized the urgency to finally invest in the long-neglected needs of working families. Now chair of the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, Sanders' $3.5 trillion budget proposal, if approved by Congress, would enact many of the proposals he championed as a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016 and 2020. It would provide funding for health care, including in-home care, and expanding Medicare to cover dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses, offer 2 years of tuition-free community college and education for pre-K, fund pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds, and offer up to 3 weeks of family paid leave. Sanders insisted the new spending would be paid for by tax increases on billionaires who don't pay a nickel in federal income taxes, and large corporations that make billions in profit and in some years do not pay a penny in federal income tax. Across the street, members of the Americans for Prosperity, which championed free market policies, argued that those tax increases will be felt by the very people Sanders is trying to help. Sanders says it's only the billionaires who are going to see their taxes go up, but lots of folks just like you and me are going to see our taxes increased as well, said Rob Peters, the grassroots director for the group. The so-called Green New Deal parts of Sanders' plan would also drive up consumer energy costs by hundreds of dollars a year. Proposed tax changes will impact farmers passing on land to younger generations, and retirement savings will be demolished by increased capital gain taxes, he said. That made it ironic that Sanders was campaigning for his plan in her district, said First District U.S. Republican Ashley Hinson. He's coming here to rural Iowa when that budget clearly does not prioritize rural America or the biofuels industry, which doesn't stand up for the farmers who are feeding and fueling the world. Sanders said lack of Republican support pains him because the investment in meeting the needs of working families is needed to restore the faith of the American people in a democratic society. We're facing massive levels of income and wealth inequality. We're facing working families and low-income families struggling in a way that they have not struggled for a long time. What this legislation is about, to me personally, said Sanders, is not just improving life for millions and millions of working people. It's making people understand that government can, in fact, in a democratic society, work for working families and not just the wealthy and the powerful. Millions of Americans have given up on democracy because they're not working longer and harder without any real, because they are working longer and harder without any real gain in their paychecks in 40 years. They can't afford child care or health care. They can't afford to send their kids to college. They can't afford housing. And they look around and say, does anybody care about me? He's hopeful that congressional opposition to his plan can be overcome. There haven't been any Republican votes for his plan so far, and Sanders said he isn't counting on any. It's just as hard for me literally to understand how Republican colleagues who are dads and moms and grandfathers and grandmothers are not worried about what climate change is doing to the future of this planet for our own kids and grandkids. I just don't get that. Republicans, Sanders asserted, understand they are more interested in representing the wealthy and powerful rather than the working families in their districts. Okay, we're going to move now back to the front page. U.S. drone strike killed IS bombers. In Afghanistan, the U.S. drone strike blew up a vehicle carrying multiple suicide bombers from Afghanistan's Islamic State affiliate on Sunday before they could attack the ongoing military evacuation at Kabul's International Airport. An Afghan official said 3 children were killed in the strike. The strike came just 2 days before the U.S. is set to conclude a massive 2-week-long airlift of more than 114,000 Afghans and foreigners and withdraw the last of its troop, ending America's longest war with the Taliban back in power. Also on Sunday, President Joe Biden stood witness with grieving families under a gray sky as one by one the remains of 13 U.S. troops killed in Kabul suicide bombings were removed was solemnity from a military aircraft that brought them home. Biden and his wife Jill met privately with family members of those killed in the suicide attack near the Kabul airport before the president became the fourth commander-in-chief over two decades of war to stand at attention at Dover Air Force Base as the remains of the fallen from Afghanistan returned home. The U.S. State Department on Sunday released a statement signed by around 100 countries as well as NATO and the European Union, saying that they had received assurances from the Taliban that people with travel documents would still be able to leave the country. The Taliban said they will allow normal travel after the U.S. withdrawal is completed on Tuesday, and they assume control of the airport. The Afghan officials spoke on condition of anonymity because of security reasons. Witnesses to the drone strike said it targeted two cars parked in a residential building near the airport, killing and wounding several civilians. There was no immediate comment from the U.S. officials after the reports of civilian casualties surfaced. Two American military officials who spoke anonymously to discuss military operations had earlier called the airstrike successful and said the vehicle it targeted carried multiple bombers. U.S. Navy Captain Bill Urban, a military spokesman, had earlier said the military was investigating whether there were civilian casualties, but at that time we had no indication. We are confident we were successfully hit the target. Significant secondary explosions from the vehicle indicated the presence of a substantial amount of explosive material. The strike came 2 days after an Islamic State suicide attack outside the airport killed at least 169 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members. The U.S. carried out a drone strike elsewhere in the country on Saturday that said it killed two ISIS members. The Sunni extremists of IS, with links to the group's more well-known affiliate in Syria and Iraq, have carried out a series of attacks, mainly targeting Afghanistan's Shiite Muslim minority, including a 2020 assault on a maternity hospital in Kabul that killed women and newborns. The Taliban have fought against the IS affiliate in the past and have pledged not to allow Afghanistan to become a base for terror attacks. The U.S.-led invasion in 2001 came in response to the 9/11 attacks, which al-Qaeda planned and executed while being sheltered by the Taliban. The Taliban increased security around the airport after Thursday's attack, clearing away the large crowds that had gathered outside the gates hoping to join the airlift. Britain ended its evacuation flight Saturday, and more U.S. allies concluded theirs earlier in the week. But U.S. military cargo planes continued their runs in the airport Sunday, ahead of a Tuesday deadline set by President Joe Biden to withdraw all American troops. Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. has the capacity to evacuate the estimated 300 Americans who remain in the country and wish to leave. He said the U.S. does not currently plan to have an ongoing embassy presence after the withdrawal, but will ensure safe passage for any American citizen, any legal permanent resident, after Tuesday, as well as for those Afghans who helped us. In interviews with Sunday talk shows, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. was working with other countries to ensure the airport functions normally after the withdrawal and that the Taliban allows people to travel freely. All right, that's it for our front page news. So we're going to move inside. A story of local interest, pickup and driver recovered from Missouri River. Dive crews recovered a pickup truck and the remains of a driver from the Missouri River Sunday morning. Around 10:27 p.m. Saturday, the Sioux City Police Department received a report of a pickup that had lost control while traveling south on Interstate 29 at about mile marker 150 and drove into the Missouri River. Responding officers located where the truck went into the river and found that it was fully underwater. Sioux City Fire Rescue and Urban Search and Rescue Task Force 1 dive team began efforts to retrieve the vehicle from the water, but were unsuccessful during the overnight hours due to conditions in the area. Recovery efforts resumed on Sunday morning, and at 11:20 a.m., the divers successfully recovered the truck from the water. The remains of the driver, whose name will not publicly be released for 24 hours, were recovered in the vehicle. Authorities were able to positively identify the driver and have made contact with his family. The accident is under investigation, but appears that the weather was a factor as it was raining heavily at the time. Okay, in other national news, actor Ed Asner dies at 91. In Los Angeles, Ed Asner, the burly and prolific character actor who became a star in middle age as the gruff but lovable newsman Lou Grant, first in the hit comedy The Mary Tyler Moore Show and later in the drama Lou Grant, died on Sunday. He was 91. Asner's representative confirmed the actor's death in an email to the Associated Press. Asner's official Twitter account included a note from his children. "We are sorry to say that our beloved patriarch passed away this morning peacefully. Words cannot express the sadness we feel. With a kiss on your head, good night, Dad. We love you." Built like a football lineman he once was, the balding Asner was a journeyman actor in films and TV when he was hired in 1970 to play Lou Grant on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. For 7 seasons, he was the rumpled boss to Moore's ebullient Mary Richards. He called her Mary, she called him Mr. Grant, at the fictional Minneapolis TV newsroom where both worked. Later, he would play the role for 5 more years on Lou Grant. Asner's character had caught on from the first episode when he told Mary, "You've got spunk, and I hate spunk." The inspired cast included Ted Knight as Ted Baxter, the dim-witted news anchor, Gavin McLeod as Marie Slaughter and sarcastic news writer, and Betty White as the manipulative, sex-obsessed home show hostess Sue Ann Nevins. Valerie Harper and Cloris Leachman, playing Mary's neighbors, both saw their characters spun off into their own shows. Asner is the 3rd Mary Tyler Moore alum to die in recent months. Leachman died in January and McLeod died in May. The 99-year-old White is the lone surviving main cast member from Mary Tyler Moore. Mary Tyler Moore was still a hit when the star decided to pursue other interests, so it was brought to the end in the 7th season with a hilarious finale in which all of the principals were fired except for bumbling Baxter. Asner went immediately into Lou Grant, his character moving from Minneapolis to L.A., to become the city editor of the Tribune, a crusading newspaper under the firm hand of publisher Margaret Pynchon, memorably played by Nancy Marchland. Asner won 3 Best Supporting Actor Emmys on Mary Tyler Moore and 2 Best Actor Awards on Lou Grant. He also won Emmys for his roles in Rich Man, Poor Man and Roots. He had more than 300 acting credits and remained active throughout his 70s and 80s in a variety of film and TV roles. In 2003, he played Santa Claus in Will Ferrell's hit film Elf. He was John Goodman's father in the short-lived comedy Center of the Universe and the voice of the elderly hero in the hit 2009 Pixar release Up. More recently, he was in a TV series called Forgive Me and Dead to Me. Nonetheless, Asner told the AP in 2009 that interesting roles were hard to come by. "I never get enough work. It's the history of my career. There just isn't anything to turn down, let me put it that way. I'd say most people are probably in that same boat, old people, and it's a shame." As Screen Actor Guild's president, the liberal Asner was caught up in a political controversy In 1982, when he spoke out against U.S. involvement with repressive governments in Latin America, Lou Grant was canceled during the furor that followed, and he did not run for a third SAG term in 1985. Okay. Going to move on now to national news. Experts warn of voter system software breaches in Atlanta. Republican efforts questioning the outcome of the 2020 presidential race have led to voting system breaches that election security experts say pose a heightened risk to future elections. Copies of the Dominion voting system software used to manage elections, from designing ballots to configuring voting machines and tallying results, were distributed at an event this month in South Dakota's organized by MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, an ally of former President Donald Trump, who has made unsubstantiated claims about last year's election. It's a game changer in the environment we have talked about existing now as a reality, said Matt Masterson, a former top election security official in the Trump administration. We told election officials essentially that you should assume this information is already out there. Now we know it is, and we don't know what we're going to do about it. The software companies came from voting equipment in Mesa County, Colorado, in Michigan, where Trump allies had sued unsuccessfully, challenging the results from last fall. The Dominion software is used in 30 states. Election security pioneer Harry Hursty was at the South Dakota event and said he and other researchers in attendance were provided three separate copies of election management systems that run on the Dominion software. The data indicated they were from Antrim and Mesa counties. While not clear how the copies came to be released at the event, they were posted online and made available for public download. The release gives hacker a practice environment to probe for vulnerabilities they could exploit and a roadmap to avoid defenses. All the hackers would need is physical access to the systems because they are not supposed to be connected to the internet. The door is now wide open. The only question is, how do you sneak in the door? A Dominion representative declined comment, citing an investigation. The company has filed lawsuits contesting various unfounded claims about its system. U.S. election technology was dominated by just three vendors, comprising 90% of the market, meaning election officials cannot easily swap out their existing technology. Release of the software copies essentially provides a blueprint for those trying to interfere. Okay, we're going to move on. Donations to racial justice causes were up last year. Donations to racial and social justice causes ticked up by 16% of American households in 2020 as donors raced to provide support to affected communities in a year marked by protests and increased attention on racism in America. The study by Indiana University's Lilly School of Philanthropy, released last week, found the bump in giving was driven by contributions among all demographic groups, although it noted Asian American and Black households were more likely to donate to such causes than their white counterparts. Nearly a third of Asian American households and 19% of Black households donated to those causes. A lot of attention so far on giving to racial social justice has been on foundations and the corporate side, but it's also important to realize that everyday donors have been part of this. It's a very diverse group of donors, and donors of color are certainly leading in giving to racial and social justice. Okay. Weather heats up as fire nears Tahoe. South Lake Tahoe, California, spiking temperatures and increasing winds on Sunday added to the challenges faced by firefighters battling blazes across North California, including one that continued its march toward the Lake Tahoe Resort region. Flames churned through mountains just a few miles southwest of the Tahoe Basin, where thick smoke sent tourists packing at a time when summer vacations would be in full swing ahead of Labor Day weekend. Triple-digit temperatures were possible, and the extreme heat was expected to last several days. A red flag warning for critical fires was issued for Monday and Tuesday across the Northern Sierra. Crews working in rugged terrain scrambled to douse spot fires caused by erratic winds. More than 600 structures have been destroyed, and at least 18,000 more were under threat from the Calder Fire, which has scorched 245 square miles since it broke out on August 14th. A lovely picture of the International Space Station. A long exposure photo shows the launch of SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket on a resupply mission for NASA to the International Space Station from Pad 39A on Sunday at Kennedy Space Center, seen from Merritt Island in Florida. SpaceX is on its way with delivery. A cargo includes ants, avocados, a robotic arm, and other supplies. In Cape Canaveral, a SpaceX shipment of ants, avocados, and a robotic arm rocketed toward the International Space Station on Sunday. The delivery, due to arrive Monday, is the company's 23rd for NASA in just under a decade. A recycled Falcon rocket blasted into the pre-dawn sky from NASA's Kennedy Space Center. After hoisting the Dragon capsule, the first stage booster landed upright on SpaceX's newest ocean platform, named a shortfall of gravitas. SpaceX founder Elon Musk continued his tradition of naming the booster recovery vessels in tribute to the late science fiction writer Ian Banks. The Dragon was carrying more than 4,800 pounds of supplies and experiments, and fresh food, including avocados, lemons, and even ice cream for the space station's 7 astronauts. The Girl Scouts are sending up ants, brine shrimp, and plants as test subjects, while the University of Wisconsin-Madison scientists are flying up seeds from mouse ear cress, a small flowering weed used in genetic research. Samples of concrete, solar cells, and other materials will also be subjected to weightlessness. A Japanese startup company's experimental robotic arm, meanwhile, will attempt to screw items together in its orbital debut and perform other mundane chores normally done by the astronauts. The first test will be done inside the space station. Future models of the robot will venture out into the vacuum of space to practice satellite and other repair jobs. As early as 2025, a squad of these arms could help build lunar bases and mine the moon for precious resources. SpaceX had to leave some of the experiments behind because of delays resulting from COVID. It was the second launch attempt. Saturday's try was foiled by stormy weather. NASA turned to SpaceX and other U.S. companies to deliver cargo and crews to the space station once the space shuttle program ended in 2011. Other news briefs around the country. Arizona ends juror challenge practice. Arizona's top court is eliminating the longstanding practice of allowing lawyers in criminal and civil trials in state courts to remove potential jurors without explanation, a move that proponents said would help prevent discrimination in the selection of trial jurors. So-called peremptory challenges will end January 1 under a rule change ordered Tuesday and released Friday by the Arizona Supreme Court. In the meantime, a court task force will recommend possible changes to current court rules that will allow opposing sides in trials to ask judges to remove potential jurors for valid reasons such as stated bias or inability to serve. The two state courts of appeal judges who proposed the rule change in January said it was a clear opportunity to end definitely one of the most obvious sources of racial injustice in the courts. In Boston, a public marker to remember the enslaved Africans forced to journey across the ocean to toil in the Americas was formally dedicated Sunday on the waterfront. In Mexico, Hurricane Nora caused floods and landslides along Mexico's Pacific coast Sunday before veering into the Gulf of California and weakening into a tropical storm. In Texas, Caleb Wallace, a man who led efforts in his Central Texas community against mask wearing and other preventative measures during the pandemic, died Saturday from COVID 1 month after being admitted to the emergency room. U.S. sanctions. Iran and Syria vowed on Sunday to take mighty steps to confront U.S. sanctions imposed on their two regional allies, saying their relations will strengthen under Iran's new leadership. In Italy, firefighters on Sunday battled a high-rise blaze in Milan that spread rapidly through the 20-story residential building and poured black smoke into the air. The mayor of Milan said there were no reports of injuries or deaths, but that firefighters are kicking down doors, apartment by apartment, to ensure there were no victims. In Greenland, a team of Arctic researchers from Denmark say they accidentally discovered what they believe is the world's northernmost island located off Greenland's coast. The scientists from the University of Copenhagen initially thought they had arrived at Utikwa, an island discovered by a Danish survey team in 1978. They instead wound up on an undiscovered island farther north. Okay. USAID to Haiti targets areas hardest hit by the earthquake. In Jeremy, Haiti, U.S. military aircraft are now ferrying food, tarps, and other material into southern Haiti amid a shift in the international relief effort to focus on people in the areas hardest hit by the recent earthquake. Aircraft flying out of the capital, Port-au-Prince, arrived throughout the day on Saturday in the mostly rural mountainous southern peninsula that was the epicenter of the earthquake. In Jeremy, people waved and cheered as a Marine Corps unit from North Carolina descended in a tilt rotor Osprey with pallets of rice, tarps, and other supplies. Most of the supplies, however, were not destined for Jeremy. They were for distribution to mountain communities where landslides have destroyed homes and small plots of many subsistence farmers in the area. They lost their gardens, they lost their animals. The mountains slid down and they lost everything. At the request of the Haitian government, getting as much help as possible to such people is now the focus on the $32 million relief effort, said Tim Callahan. The magnitude 7.2 earthquake killed more than 2,200 people and damaged more than 100,000 homes. All right, we're going to continue on with other news. An ex-UK Marine leaves Kabul with dogs and cats. A former UK Royal Marine who waged a high-profile campaign to leave Afghanistan with almost 200 rescued dogs and cats has flown to safety with the animals, but without his charity's Afghan staff who were left behind in Kabul. A privately funded chartered plane carrying Paul Farthing and his animals landed at London's Heathrow Airport on Sunday. And a veterinarian involved in the effort said the animals appeared healthy and have been placed in quarantine. Farthing, who started the charity after serving with British forces in Afghanistan 15 years ago, was eligible for evacuation in Britain's military aircraft along with Afghan members of staff and dependents, but he refused to leave without the animals. So he left. He chronicled his attempts to depart with his four-legged companions among the chaos from the Kabul airport, and his supporters lobbied the British government for help with the rescue effort dubbed Operation Ark. Farthing gained backing from celebrities, including Ricky Gervais and many offers to adopt the rescued animals. But he drew criticism from those who said the case was draining time and energy from the fast task of rescuing Afghans at risk from the country's new Taliban rulers. Britain said it evacuated more than 15,000 UK citizens and vulnerable Afghans in the two-week airlift that ended Saturday. But officials say as many as 1,100 Afghans who were entitled to come to the UK have been left behind. Some British lawmakers who have been trying to help stranded constituents and their families believe the true total is higher. What would you say if you sent an ambulance to save my dog rather than to save your mother? We've used a lot of troops to bring in 200 dogs. Meanwhile, my interpreter's family is likely to be killed. So, all right, we're going to move to the area of sports. Briarcliff opens season with a loss. The Briarcliff University football team suffered a 30-3 season opening loss on Saturday to Waldorf in Forest City. The Warriors put points on the board on their first drive of the game and never looked back, outscoring the Chargers 23-0 in the first half. Briarcliff's defense gave up just one score in the fourth quarter. The Chargers were unable to score themselves until the fourth, when a field goal accounted for Briarcliff's only points of the game. In other football, Northwestern won 66 over Presentation, who scored 9. All right. Sweet Sunday sweep. Hope is still alive for the Sioux City Explorers. The Exes gave their fans a show in the final two home games of the regular season on Sunday with a critical doubleheader sweep of Sioux Falls. There were plenty of fireworks for fans to watch as the doubleheader saw ejections, a pair of solid pitching performances from Explorers starters, and a record-setting home run from third baseman Jose Sermo. In Game 1, the Exes scored 4-3 over the Canaries. Then in Game 2, a 3-0 victory, a pair of home runs from Sermo and Sebastian Zuada lifted the Exes. Sermo's bomb was his 28th of the season, which broke the Exes' single-season home run record, previously set by Kevin Garner in 1997. The wins pulled the Exes to within a half game of Lincoln in the American Association South Division wild card standings after the Salt Dogs took down Claiborne on Sunday 8-2. Sioux Falls struck first on offense in Game 1, and the Canaries scored 2 runs in the third. But the Exes ended up winning both games. So, in a dramatic end to golf, Patrick Cantlay outlasts Bryson DeChambeau in a dramatic 6-hole playoff. In Maryland, outside of Baltimore, in a place called Caves Valley, Patrick Cantlay had enough on his hands to keep his attention Sunday as he was locked in an epic battle with Bryson DeChambeau, a compelling contrast of styles and personalities Sunday in the BMW Championship. Even so, he couldn't ignore what fans shouted from behind the ropes Sunday at Caves Valley. Patty Ice. With the putter in his hand and ice in his veins, Cantlay delivered one clutch putt after another to survive the final 3 holes of regulation and 6 tense holes of sudden death playoff, finally winning with a 20-foot birdie putt on the 18th hole. The most important putt? It was hard to tell. He closed out his 6-under 66 with an 8-foot par putt on the 16th, an 8-foot bogey putt on the 17th, and a tee shot into the water, and a 20-foot birdie putt on the 18th to force a playoff. Twice on the 18th in the playoff, where DeChambeau had a 30-yard advantage off the tee, Cantlay made par putts from 6 and 7 feet, but the most important putt was the last one. They all mattered, I guess, the same. I needed all of them. DeChambeau, who also closed with a 66, can pick just as many that cost him. His week featured a mystic 6-footer on the 18th for a chance at a 59 on Friday. And in the final round, he missed a 12-foot birdie putt to win in regulation. three more birdie putts in the playoff, and then his final putt to send the great theater into another amazing scene. DeChambeau, who has stopped talking to any media that isn't a PGA Tour partner, refused comment for everyone on Sunday. He became the first player in PGA Tour history to post 261 without taking home a trophy. Cantlay received two trophies, one from the BMW Championship and the other from the century-old Western Golf Association, and plenty of other perks for his PGA Tour leading third victory of the season and fifth overall. That moved him to number one in the FedEx Cup, news he met by saying, "I know." That means Cantlay goes to the Tour Championship next week with a two-shot lead over Tony Finau in the FedEx Cup finale with $15 million to the winner. In other sports news, the Cubs beat the Black Raiders at ACHS. The East High volleyball team played one late match, last match late Saturday at the Ankeny Centennial Tournament. The Black Raiders played Nevada, but the Cubs won the match 25-23, 25-27, and 15-6. Wow, close matches. And let's see if we have any other sports news. Hail to the victors. Michigan beats Ohio for the Little League title. Twice, Jackson Surma walked to the plate with runners in scoring position in the biggest game of his young life, and both times he delivered. Jackson drove in four runs, and Ethan Van Bell struck out eight as Michigan beat Ohio 5-2 on Sunday in the championship game of the Little League World Series. Well, congratulations to them. Okay. We're going to see if there's any last-minute news. We'll go back to a little bit of personal finance news before we finish. What is FAANG stocks, which I see referenced now and then? The acronym FAANG refers to a group of high-profile technology companies with high-performing stocks: Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google's parent, Alphabet. These days, the businesses are so popular that their stock market value is so high. All but Netflix recently had market capitalizations of $1 trillion or more, and Apple's was recently $2.4 trillion, that some suggest the stocks are way overpriced. They may be occasionally overpriced, but in general, they've earned their values through their dominance. Consider, for example, that Facebook recently reported 2.9 billion monthly active users, and it owns Instagram as well. Amazon, meanwhile, is the world's largest consumer-serving e-commerce company, and its Amazon Web Services is the dominant cloud computing service. Amazon also recently employed over 1.3 million people globally. Okay, that's it for today. I'm going to quickly recap this week's weather. We are going to have a warm week with some storms possible. Bear with me while I go back to our weather. Today, high of 78 with a little bit of wind and a possible thunderstorm tonight. Low of 63. Tuesday, high of 77, sunny. Wednesday, 83 and sunny. Thursday, 86 and sunny. And cloudy on Friday, high of 80. So have a great week ahead. Thank you again for joining me. My name is Barb, and I've been reading to you the Sioux City Journal on Monday, August 30th. Have a great week, and thank you again to the Sioux City Journal and to IRIS, Iowa's Radio Reading Network. Thank you, and have a great week.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. One June, a man climbed into the Ürzel Alps on today's Austrian-Italian border. Dressed in leather and fur, he was mid-40s and extremely fit. He carried a wooden bow, flint-tipped arrows, and a copper axe. He had no way of knowing that in an hour, he'd be dead. 5,300 years later, some hikers discovered his body melting out of a glacier. Local police called in forensic experts, and so began a 30-year investigation into the best-preserved mummy from pre-modern history. They traced the minerals in his teeth to a nearby groundwater source to determine where he lived. They looked at food and pollen in his gut to recreate his last day of meals and where he ate them. Ürzi the Iceman, as they called him, had walked from his mountain home to the valley floor. That night, judging from a telltale slash on his hand, he got into a knife fight. The wound had begun to heal by the time he died, suggesting he won it. What had not healed were a fatal arrow wound to his back and a cracked skull. Someone had tracked him into the mountains and ambushed him. His valuable copper axe was not taken, suggesting a revenge killing. Perhaps the killers buried him in snow, beginning his mummification. Today, Ürzi rests in a museum freezer near where he was discovered. A model of him in life stands in the same building, while 3D printings of his body are studied around the world. I'm Scott Tinker, wrapping up a very cold case on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.